My main object, when on active service, was to get as much as possible charted in the shortest available time, in order that full advantage should be taken of intervals of fine weather. My quest, since I retired, has been to ascertain whether or not there is a field of consciousness around us inhabited by intelligent beings who think as we think, talk as we talk, who have memories and take in knowledge, who can identify themselves as people we have known, and consequently can be reasonably termed the discarnate spirits of those who were once dwellers upon this earth. This quest requires all the powers of observation which an investigator can muster. It is a difficult study, often very baffling, full of disappointments and apparent inconsistencies. Careful records, critical analysis, and acumen are needed, much the same qualities as are demanded of a naval surveyor. The one occupation is not a bad introduction to the other. My natural powers of seeing and hearing are now much the same as those of the average men of my age, but I am of opinion that the occupation of my life afforded me the sort of training which is required for psychic investigation. I started in with no desire for consolation and no preconceived views on the subject of occult study. In short, I believe my records are as much to be trusted as those of any of my predecessors who have devoted much time to this most fascinating branch of research. I am aware that if I had published this book 60 years ago, possibly even at a more recent date, it could have been successfully used against me as evidence that I was insane, and if anybody was sufficiently interested in my small property to wish to wrest it from me, he could have done so with the assistance of three physicians. Probably I should have been incarcerated in an asylum. In the United States, such would be my fate today. Happily for me, I do not live in that benighted country, and am able to publish my notes in a land which is really free and not hidebound by ignorant dogmatism. America has produced some fine poets and spiritists, but the general materialism of the masses prevents even these men from having the influence they would have had if they had lived in this country. One of the greatest souls of the 19th century, if not indeed the greatest, Abraham Lincoln, was a spiritualist at heart, but even the knowledge of this fact has not caused the shallow scoffers to pause in their contemptible skepticism. I do not think that there are 250,000 people, all told, in North America who are professed spiritists. The following story has been published by a girl medium for whose gifts the great president had a sincere respect. Mrs. Lincoln received us graciously, and introduced us to a gentleman and lady present, whose names I have forgotten. Mr. Lincoln was not then present. While all were conversing pleasantly on general subjects, Mrs. Miller, Mr. Lorry's daughter, seated herself, under control, at the double grand piano at one side of the room, seemingly awaiting someone. Mrs. Lincoln was talking with us in a pleasant strain when suddenly Mrs. Miller's hands fell upon the keys with a force that betokened a master hand, and the strains of a grand march filled the room. As the measured notes rose and fell, we became silent. The heavy end of the piano began rising and falling in perfect time to the music. All at once it ceased, and Mr. Lincoln stood upon the threshold of the room. He afterwards informed us that the first notes of the music fell upon his ears as he reached the head of the grand staircase to descend, and that he kept step to the music until he reached the doorway. Mr. and Mrs. Lorry and Mrs. Miller were duly presented. Then I was led forward and presented. He stood before me, tall and kindly, with a smile on his face. Dropping his hand upon my head, he said, in a humorous tone, "So this is our little Nettie, is it, that we have heard so much about?" I could only smile and say, "Yes, sir," like any schoolgirl, when he kindly led me to an ottoman. Sitting down in a chair, the ottoman at his feet, he began asking me questions in a kindly way about my mediumship, and I think he must have thought me stupid, as my answers were little beyond a yes and no. His manner, however, was genial and kind, and it was then suggested we form a circle. He said, "Well, how do you do it?" looking at me. Mr. Lorry came to the rescue, and said we had been accustomed to sit in a circle and to join hands, but he did not think it would be necessary in this instance. While he was yet speaking, I lost all consciousness of my surroundings and passed under control. For more than an hour I was made to talk to him, and I learned from my friends afterwards that it was upon matters that he seemed fully to understand, while they compassed-handed very little until that portion was reached that related to the forthcoming Emancipation Proclamation. He was charged, with the utmost solemnity and force of manner, not to abate the terms of its issue, and not to delay its enforcement as a law beyond the opening of the year, and he was assured that it was to be the crowning event of his administration and his life, and that while he was being counseled by strong parties to defer the enforcement of it, hoping to supplant it by other measures and to delay action, he must in no wise heed such counsel, but stand firm to his convictions, and fearlessly perform the work and fulfill the mission for which 1W had been raised up by an overruling providence. Those present declared that they lost sight of the timid girl in the majesty of the utterance, the strength and force of the language, and the importance of that which was conveyed, and seemed to realize that some strong masculine spirit force was giving speech to almost divine commands. I shall never forget the scene around me when I regained consciousness. I was standing in front of Mr. Lincoln, and he was sitting back in his chair, with his arms folded upon his breast, looking intently at me. I stepped back, naturally confused at the situation, not remembering at once where I was, and glancing round the group, where perfect silence reigned. It took me a moment to remember my whereabouts. A gentleman present then said, in a low tone, "Mr. President, did you notice anything peculiar in the method of address?" Mr. Lincoln raised himself as if shaking off his spell. He glanced quickly at the full-length portrait of Daniel Webster that hung above the piano, and replied, "Yes, and it is very singular, very," with a marked emphasis. Mr. Sum said, "Mr. President, would it be improper for me to inquire whether there has been any pressure brought to bear upon you to defer the enforcement of the proclamation?" To which the President replied, "Under these circumstances that question is perfectly proper, as we are all friends," smiling upon the company. "It is taking all my nerve and strength to withstand such a pressure." At this point the gentlemen drew around him and spoke together in low tones, Mr. Lincoln saying least of all. At last he turned to me and, laying his hand upon my head, uttered these words, in a manner that I shall never forget, "My child, you possess a very singular gift, but that it is of God I have no doubt. I thank you for coming here tonight. It is more important than perhaps anyone present can understand. I must leave you all now, but hope I shall see you again." He shook me kindly by the hand, bowed to the rest of the company, and was gone. Lincoln did not disdain to study the physical phenomena of psychical research. Here is another extract. It was at this séance that Mrs. Bellmiller gave an example of her power as a moving medium, and highly amused and interested us by causing the piano to waltz round the room, as was facetiously remarked in several recent newspaper articles. The true statement is as follows: Mrs. Miller played upon the piano, a three-corner grand, and under her influence it rose and fell, keeping time to her touch in a perfectly regular manner. Mr. Lorry suggested that, as an added test of the invisible power that moved the piano, Mrs. Miller, his daughter, should place her hand on the instrument, standing at arm's length from it, to show that she was in no wise connected with its movement other than as agent. Mr. Lincoln then placed his hand underneath the piano at the end nearest Mrs. Miller, who placed her left hand upon his to demonstrate that neither strength nor pressure was used. In this position the piano rose and fell a number of times at her bidding. At Mr. Lorry's desire the President changed his position to another side, meeting with the same result. The President, with a quaint smile, said, "I think we can hold down this instrument." Whereupon he climbed upon it, sitting with his legs dangling over the side, as also did Mr. Sums, S.B.K.'s, and a soldier in the uniform of a major, who, if living, will recall the strange scene from the Army of the Potomac. The piano, notwithstanding this enormous added weight, continued to wobble about, until the sitters were glad to vacate the premises. We were convinced that there were no mechanical contrivances to produce the strange result, and Mr. Lincoln expressed himself perfectly satisfied that the motion was caused by some invisible power, and when Mr. Sums remarked, "When I have related to my acquaintances, Mr. President, that which I have experienced tonight, they will say, with a knowing look and wise demeanor, you were psychologized, and, as a matter of fact, versus fancy, you did not see what you in reality did see," Mr. Lincoln quietly replied. "You should bring such person here, and, when the piano seems to rise, have him slip his foot under the leg, and be convinced, doubtless, by the weight of evidence resting upon his understanding." Lincoln was not the only genius in America who has given proof of his belief in Spiritism. About the time of the revival of Spiritism in Rochester, N.Y., the poet Longfellow lost a child. He probably never heard of the excitement going on so far away from where he lived. But, as he mused over the passing out of his little girl, he was inspired to pen his famous poem called Resignation. "We see but dimly through the mists and vapors, amid these earthly damps, what seem to us but sad, funereal tapers, maybe heaven's distant lamps. There is no death. What seems so is transition. This life of mortal breath is but the suburb of the life Elysian, whose portal we call death." Then he refers to his bereavement: "Not as a child shall we again behold her, for when with raptures wild in our embraces we again enfold her, she will not be a child, but a fair maiden, in her Fatbe's mansion, clothed with celestial grace and beautiful with all the soul's expansion shall we behold her face." The man who wrote these lines was, undoubtedly, a spiritist. He knew that his child was alive and near him, that she would grow up in spirit life, and that in a few short years he would meet her face to face, without waiting for some indefinite millions of years and a day of judgment. Many other Americans distinguished in law, science, and art have freely and courageously given their experiences to the public and professed themselves spiritists in the truest sense. The Five Foolish Questions. The following queries have been often put to me, and I presume other investigators have not been more fortunate. I will make an attempt to answer them, as it will save much time and friction in the future. 1. What is the good of it all? 2. Why is darkness necessary? 3. Why do mediums require to be paid? 4. Why are they always ignorant, uncultured people? 5. Why is no useful, material information given at seances? 1. What is the good of it all? Is it of no good that men and women are comforted in bereavement by the knowledge that those they have loved and lost are alive and watching over them? Church eschatology does not teach this. It puts forward quite a different doctrine. It tells of a separation of the spirit from the body, certainly. The spirit goes into some region unknown, where it, apparently, has nothing to do until some very remote date, possibly billions of years hence, when it joins the body again for the day of judgment. On that day its doom is sealed. It may be a sheep and attain everlasting happiness, or a goat and be thrown into hell. Quite lately the Book of Hymns Ancient and Modern was revised, and the following hymn, 499, was retained by common consent: on the resurrection morning soul and body meet again, no more sorrow, no more weeping, no more pain. Here a while they must be parted, and the flesh its Sabbath keep, waiting in a holy stillness, wrapped in sleep. For a while the tired body lies with feet toward the morn, till the last and brighter Easter day be born. Soul and body reunited henceforth nothing shall divide, waking up in Christ's own likeness satisfied. On that happy Easter morning all the graves their dead restore, father, sister, child, and mother, meet once more. If this hymn means anything at all, it is an explicit announcement that, until some vague resurrection day, father, sister, child and mother do not meet or commune with one another. What comfort does this give to the sorrowing earth spirit who remains behind? Those who believe in this pernicious doctrine are of all men most to be pitied. The whole doctrine, as taught by the churches, of a bodily resurrection and a judgment day full of horrors, is barbaric, and does not yield one scrap of comfort to the sorrowing survivor. But those who have assured themselves by experiment and research of the grand truths of Spiritism, how differently do they regard physical death? The lost child is not gone, only removed from sight and in a region of happy consciousness where it has wider opportunities and greater facilities of expansion than it had on the earth plane, from whence, under certain favorable conditions, it can commune, sometimes even by speech, and always by impression, with its parent and other loved ones it has left behind. Is it possible to overestimate the value of such knowledge? It has saved many a parent and lover from loss of their reason. It has softened the otherwise unsupportable feeling of cruel break in their affections, and given hope to thousands who know that in a few years they will again join the object of their solicitude. 50 years ago, when the great American nation was in the throes of a mighty conflict, its destiny was controlled by that great and good man Abraham Lincoln, who believed in communication with the next state. During that gigantic struggle, 1 million of able-bodied men in their prime passed on to the other life. The poet, Walt Whitman, in his ode to his hero, thus wrote of them: "I saw battle corpses, myriads of them, and the white skeletons of young men, I saw them, I saw the debris and abris of all the slain soldiers of the war, but I saw they were not as was thought, they themselves were fully addressed, they suffered not, the living remained and suffered, the mother suffered, and the wife and the child suffered, and the musing comrade suffered, and the armies that remained suffered. What is the good of it all? Think you it is no good for the wife and the child that remained and suffered, to know that he whom they loved was still alive and near them, though unseen? As I have said, I was not brought into state of knowledge by any need of consolation. But I may require it any day. No one can tell what misfortunes are in store for him. I, for one, therefore, cannot write with patience of those undeveloped spirits now in the earth sphere, who shout in sneering tones, 'What is the good of it all?'" On June 8, 1902, the Bishop of London preached an eloquent sermon in St. Paul's Cathedral on the blessing of peace. He recalled the many deaths in our struggle with the Boers who can forget the lists of killed and wounded, and the rows of photographs in the illustrated papers of so many, still looking little more than boys, who had passed away. "O bitter wind, towards the sunset blowing, what of the dales do night? In yonder grey old hall what fires are glowing, what ring of festal light? In the great window as the day was dwindling I saw an old man stand, his head was proudly held, and his eyes kindling, but the list shook in his hand. O wind of twilight, was there no word uttered, no sound of joy or wail? A great fight and a good death, he muttered, trust him, he would not fail. What of the chamber dark where she was lying, for whom all life is done? Within her heart she rocks a dead child, crying, 'My son, my little son.'" Yes. It is when we recall all that war means to both sides and to all classes, that, while the great hall is desolated, the little cottage mourns quite as truly in the lad they sent from the country village or the crowded town, as he lies dead on the veldt, with a fleck of blood on his pallid lip, and a film of white on his eye, and that the Boer mother quite as truly cries, "My son, my little son," then it is that by contrast we understand what we mean when we look in one another's faces and cry, "The blessing of peace." The good bishop from whose sermon this is an extract has oft-times told his hearers that what a man is 5 minutes before death, so he is 5 minutes after. He got that piece of information from his own heart, but not from either his Bible or his prayer book. His own accounts of his mission show that he is a psychic, but does not know it. He preaches against spiritism, and is yet a spiritist. But what of the sorrow in the hall, the cottage, and the Boer home? Can we not imagine the comfort of a bereaved father and mother if they know that their son is alive and near them, though his corpse is unburied on the veldt, that they may even see him and have speech with him in a few days, in any case, only a brief time, and they will join him in a state where they will not part again? When the spiritist answers the question, "What is the good of it all?" if, indeed, he has the patience to do so, some churchmen reply, "We don't want spiritism to teach us that, it is a part of our religion." Strange blunder. Is there any word in church teaching which leads one to suppose that our departed friends are in our proximity, and able to communicate with us? The Apostles' Creed has, "I believe in the communion of saints, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting." The Nicene Creed, whose antecedents are far more satisfactory, says nothing of the communion of saints, and winds up with, "And I look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come." But where do we find any hint of a communion of sinners, or of a spirit life around us, a state of consciousness as real as that in which we live, a region inhabited by those we knew and, in some cases, loved, when they functioned on the earth plane? It is reserved for Spiritism to teach of communion with those who precede us into the next life, and the good that can be achieved, not only by the spirits of the dead communing with us, but by our communing with them. It is not in the Anglican or Roman Church that any consolation will be found for those who are bereaved. The resurrection spoken of in the creeds undoubtedly means the resurrection of the physical body. It is quite possible, and I, for one, think highly probable, that Paul was writing all the time of the resurrection of the spirit of man, and that he did not believe in the resurrection of the physical body. He was a gifted psychic and clever scholar, not one likely to credit such folly. But, if he meant this, he did not express himself in a very felicitous manner, and the churches adopt the view that the spirit does not make itself known to earth spirits until some awful day, when one portion of the human race past and present are to be detailed for everlasting happiness, the other for everlasting torment. To the foolish person who asks, "What is the good of it all?" I reply, "None, to you, but a great deal to those who can, by preparation, assimilate the great truths of Spiritism." To why is darkness necessary? This I have done my best to answer on pp. 10-12. Surely there can be but few people who are ignorant of the fact that solar rays have a destructive effect on many things. Light a fire in a room and make it up to a good strength with the sun shining directly on it, if left for half an hour, it will go out. Wireless messages can be projected far greater distances in the night than in the day. All mammals must be gestated in pitch darkness. Why suppose that their simulacra should be built up in light? As to etherealizations, it is obvious that they could not be seen unless it was dark, nor would it be possible to see many of the less substantial forms of materialization in light. It is futile complaining of conditions. This can be done, that cannot. Pictures can be precipitated in sunlight, the more light the better. We know not why, nor do we know fully why certain spiritistic manifestations are more easily exhibited in the dark. At some future date, no doubt, we shall find out. There are all sorts of conundrums I should like to have answered. Why do the wicked flourish? Why am I allowed to see only one side of the moon? 3. Why do mediums require to be paid? Of all the 5 questions, this, in my opinion, is the least sensible and logical. Do you expect people who have developed extraordinary gifts to serve you, for nothing? Is there any man of nice feeling who would like to occupy the time of a medium, or to drain his vitality, for his own convenience, without payment? Surely not. If you think mediums ought to give their services gratuitously, why do you not object to pay your parson, your doctor, or your lawyer? And why, pray, do you not object to pay for your coals? The exercise of psychic gifts is perfectly legitimate if performed in the right way. When human beings sit with a deliberate intention of encouraging visits from subhuman spirits, or spirits of the second sphere, the intercourse is called black magic, and is of evil. It is distinctly wrong to part with a portion of your vitality to enable any but human and decent spirits to manifest. But if you have assured yourself that you are dealing with none but the discarnate spirits of those who have lived upon the earth, without committing crimes which would place them in the second sphere, you are conducting a legitimate intercourse, and one which leads to good. Mediums, when once they have developed their gift, are quite unfit for other walks in life. Has anyone a right to say, you are impostors because you accept payment for your work? The idea is pure folly. For why are mediums always ignorant and uncultured people? Answer, they are not. There are as many psychics among the well-to-do, 1,000, as there are among the poor and uneducated. Many of the well-born do not know that they have these gifts, but there are thousands in the world who do, and who exercise them for the benefit of their intimate friends. These private psychics are little known. It requires great effrontery for a man to ask his friend to deplete himself for his exclusive benefit. The gift must be exercised in a purely voluntary manner, and in such a way that secrecy is ensured. We have not arrived yet, even in England, at that state of toleration when men or women, in what is termed society, can afford to let it be known that they possess uncanny gifts. There is another side to this question. The uncultured medium is of the greatest value on account of his ignorance. He gives utterance, in trance and out of it, to names, incidents, and descriptions of personalities of which, in his normal condition, it is impossible he can know anything. Evidence through such a source is far more valuable than when the psychic is well-read and has a rich subliminal record. This is one of the features which make the phenomena through the mediumship of Mrs. Rhett so intrinsically important. She comes to England on a visit to Mr. W. T. Stead. Her knowledge of the history of the United States is scanty enough, of that of Great Britain nothing at all. Within a fortnight of her arrival, the spirit of an eminent Englishman who died the possessor of great wealth manifests to me, who did not know him in his earth life. He whispers in my ear a statement of great importance, the story of a wrong done in haste to a friend, another distinguished Englishman whom it is my privilege to know well. I am not to write it down, but to tell my friend when I see him of his bitter regrets. I find later that the statement made to me by the spirit is true. The psychic knew nothing of the life history of the spirit, nor did she hear the message given to me. The evidential value of the communication would have been strong even if Mrs. Rhett had known of the spirit in his earth life, and heard what he said to me, because it was conveyed by the direct voice. But how much stronger does it become when I know that the psychic never had any knowledge of the history of my distinguished countryman. The greatest psychic in history is Jesus of Nazareth. Whom did he choose to assist him in his mission? Was it the rich or the well-born? Neither. It was the poor and uneducated. Note, three of his disciples were specially favored as his companions when any of his most spiritual acts were to be performed: Peter, James, and the youth John. They possessed more psychic power than the remaining nine. 5. Why is no useful, material information given by mediums? Answer. The efforts of controls at promiscuous seances are devoted to proving, in the simplest manner, that immortality is a fact. To achieve this, they assist discarnate spirits, who once lived on the earth plane, to identify themselves to their friends. At private seances, an item here and there of scientific interest is given to the sitter. I shall be surprised if some of the statements made to me by spirits during my sittings with Mr. A. W. Kaiser, at Detroit, do not prove of value in the future. Scientific information and forecasts of discoveries are not usually conveyed in this way. They are impressed directly on the minds of those who are, in the opinion of the communicator, best able to make use of them. When men of science leave the earth plane for the next state of consciousness, they continue their studies and experiment through congenial minds on earth. Thousands of earth spirits are being impressed daily by workers in the next state. Some are conscious of the help they are receiving, some are not. There is very good reason to suppose that, at the present time, Sir Isaac Newton is impressing at least one man in England with his new discoveries on gravitation and anti-gravitation. A friend of mine in Wiltshire has been working for over 15 years on the theory of gravitation. He assures me that, normally, it would be impossible for him to perform the work he has already accomplished. He is certain that he is receiving the greatest assistance from some mind not known to him, but far superior to his own. It is said that Edison and Marconi are conscious of being guided by invisible helpers. It is pure nonsense for people to say, "Why do these spirits tell us nothing useful, or above the general comprehension of the circle?" It is not at circles at all that the great minds of the next state impress the workers in this state of consciousness, but it is in their quiet hours, in their libraries, that inspiration comes upon them. There is one objection to the study and practice of spiritism which cannot be ignored, and only one. It is that so often put forward by Roman Catholics and High Churchmen, that the spirits we are dealing with are not human spirits at all, but a special breed of devils, who know our thoughts and every detail of our lives, and can construct dramatic situations at will to meet every case, and cause us to believe we are in direct communion with our departed friends. Roman Catholics, in one sense, are the greatest supporters of spiritism, for they admit all the facts. It is a matter of difficulty to get them to see a fraud when it is right under their noses, so confident are they that the phenomena of spiritism have been firmly established as true. Mr. Godfrey Raupt is the chief exponent of the devil theory in this country. He assured me on one occasion that he was certain that every psychic photograph produced by Mr. Richard Bursnell was genuine. I know for a fact, in my own experience, that such was not the case. But it would be no use trying to convince him. This gentleman has come across a vast number of evil spirits in his investigation. Of course, we know that legions of discarnate evil spirits exist in the second sphere, but they seldom trouble those to whom their visits are unwelcome. How does he manage to be on such friendly terms with this class? I do not remember having met with half a dozen in the last 7 years. I have always admired the grand consistency of the Roman Church,